It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. For centuries, people have looked at mountains with awe and wonder. We've climbed them, skied them, gone on pilgrimage and retreat to them. But today, from China to Ecuador, from the Alps to the Rockies, the people who know mountains best say something is changing.
So I have two daughters, Adelaya and Sol, 13 and 9, and we have a game that we call snow hunting.
John Hausdorfer is a mountain ecologist in Colorado.
Every month we find the snow, which is easy in the Rockies in the winter. But come July, August, September, it's very hard to find the snow. One particular snowfield I call Old Reliable. It's Yule Pass above the town of Crested Butte, Colorado. It's kind of an icy little wind deposit that is so tucked away it just never quite melts. It's enough for 30 fun slushy turns in the afternoon. I have been skiing that patch of snow since I first moved here in 1992. From New Jersey, with my mind blown that I could ski in the summer. About 3 years ago, we had a really bad snow year, and I thought, well, let's go to Old Reliable, you know? And I was concerned about climate change and snowpack, projections of 50% loss of snowpack by end of century, 75 fewer ski days. But I thought Old Reliable would take care of us. And when we got there, it was gone. And that, to me, really was more powerful than any of the data I have seen through the years as an environmental studies professor on climate change. This look in Sol's eyes when she couldn't participate in a family rite of passage. It just made it real. The part that was left of the snowfield was a very steep little section through rocks, ending in rock, that my older daughter was skilled enough to ski, and I wouldn't let my younger daughter go. And the tears in her eyes were like a weird kind of crying that's for a new Anthropocene. You know, like climate tears or something. It broke my heart.
Crying over the fate of a mountain doesn't seem that unusual anymore. Not when wildfires are destroying millions of acres in the West. Climate change is putting pressure on a lot of the places we love, especially mountains. And that's reminding us of how interwoven our lives are with the rest of this living planet. From his base in Gunnison, Colorado, John Hausdorfer works with mountain communities all over the world, learning to see mountains differently, not as natural resources, but as living kin. And that begins with a simple realization. Mountains and the snow on them are the source of life.
You know, I when my kid was really young, she suggested snow was God. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, it's the source of everything that lives, and you feel like you're flying, you feel like you're in heaven when you're floating down it. And she's like, isn't that God? You know, so it's powerful stuff. I will say that snow is my moral barometer. You know, if my grandkids taking their kid to ski Yule Pass and there's snow there, then the work my generation did meant something.
How endangered is snow? I mean, not just where you are, but all over?
Yeah, it, you know, it's hard to generalize. Looking at the climate data, like anything under 4,000 vertical in North America is in a lot of trouble. Europe is in a lot of trouble. The high mountains, it varies. We know that Gangotri Glacier, which is the first trickles of water of the Ganges, is receding by tens of meters per year. In fact, in the traditions of Hinduism and their creation story, snow has a role. And that Gangotri Glacier, it looks like a cow's snout, right? And out of it comes this milky colored water, seen as like the mother's milk of the sacred cow of the Hindu people. And when I finally trekked to Gangotri Glacier, there was a very nice man who came up to me, and he was from Chennai. He was an accountant. He was on his pilgrimage, and he was tearing up. And I asked him if he's okay. And he said, it's just very sad. And I said, why? He said, it doesn't look like a cow's snout anymore. And so, you know, you can quantify the necessary vital value of mountains. You can say, indeed, mountains make up, you know, 20% of the earth. 13% of human communities are in mountains. Just over 60% of all water consumed by humans, whether that's food or energy or water, is sourced in mountains. 25% of biodiversity exists in mountains. And we can say, yes, you can quantify how important mountains are, but you can't quantify the loss of a man saying his spirituality has been disrupted by climate change, not just how much water will be in the tap.
So, John, you do a lot of partnership work.
Yes.
Trying to build connections between mountain communities all over the world, kind of like the Sister Cities concept. What have you seen change? If folks in Telluride suddenly feel solidarity with a village in the Himalayas, what changes?
I'm really glad you used the word solidarity. I've always had a lot of hope around snow as a basis of solidarity. Those of us in the Rockies living with a degree of affluence, we're not the experts. Those who live with the consequences of my comforts have far more expertise than me with my PhD and gang of grad students. It's incredibly difficult, you know, and vital to bring together not just different data, but different ways of knowing. Different ways of knowing and understanding what makes mountains sacred. How do we quantify, qualify, and build solidarity around protecting the sacred as a global mountain community?
You and your wife have a piece of land up at, I think you said, 10,000 feet. It's a place called Terrible Mountain in Colorado. And so you bought it. Legally, you own it. But you've written that you're trying to think of it as almost like the mountain owns you, or at least that you belong to the mountain. So what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, I've always wrestled with what is my position on this place called Terrible Mountain. And I do my best to practice kinship there. For example, tree disease was spreading across the aspen community. When you look at an aspen forest, it's all one organism. So each tree is like a finger on your hand. Underneath is a tuber. And when you don't have disturbance, we don't have fire, the aspen tuber can die. And so there was disease spreading, and we wanted a place to put our shack. And so we disturbed by cutting the trees that were diseased. And now around the shack are young aspens from a regenerated tuber. And there's a thinker named Enrique Salmon who has a term called concentric. That is to act in such a way that you're not just like doing less bad, like conservationism saying, how do we not overuse the wood? You're advancing good as a member of that place. You're co-creating wildness with that place.
Wow. So instead of just picking the spot with the best view for your cabin, you picked the spot where if you built a cabin and took down some trees, it actually would be good for the forest and heal it.
Yeah. So that cabin is heated by, part of it is built by or built from and cleared from an aspen grove that was dying and being overcrowded by spruce. And so the spruce went into building materials, the aspen grove went into heating, and the clearing regenerated the tuber.
That's just kind of beautiful.
It's environmentalism that goes beyond doing less bad to ask, how can I be a member of this family? And what is my response? Not what are my rights on this land as a property owner? What are my responsibilities? We're owned by the responsibility. We don't own the right.
You've given us so much to think about. Is there a particular kinship practice you might recommend for anyone who might be, say, heading into the mountains?
Well, if you can find snow or the source of water, whether it's snow or a spring, find the source of water. And I would simply recommend just sitting with it. If you're on the east of the Continental Divide, think about what that water goes through ecologically, culturally, economically, socially, who and what it serves before it gets to the Delta and the Gulf of Mexico. If you're west of the Divide, think the same for the Colorado River all the way to the Gulf of California, and just let that trickle both make you present, feel the cold of the snow, listen to the trickle of the water. And whenever a thought distracts you, return to the cold of the snow on your hand, return to the trickle of the water you hear, and just breathe with it. Start with that moment. Once you're present to the place and the moment, then let yourself go to 30,000 feet and imagine the system and what it's asking from you. You'll learn how to be a good ancestor. The answer is in the land, in the mountains, which are the source of life for all land.
John Hausdorfer teaches at Western Colorado University. He's a co-founder of the Mountain Resilience Coalition, and he works with the UN's Mountain Partnership. He's an editor of the book, What Kind of Ancestor Do You Want to Be?, and of the Kinship series, Belonging in a World of Relations.